Joining me now are, I'm afraid to say Alvin and Lawrence Ubell, because the last time I said that, the two of you made a big thing about it. Al and Larry Ubell.
Because that's our stage names.
But in real life, are you, does Estelle call you Alvin?
Alvin.
Mm-hmm.
Alvin.
He would
and
be honey.
What does your mother call you?
Sweetie. He would be honey, I would be sweetie.
We have Alvin and Sweetie Ubell here. Also known as Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York.
But by the way, that's always a bad one to ask. What does your mother call your father? You know, my sister's a teacher, and she wants to ask that, and she never asked that one again.
But we call you the gurus of how to.
Yes.
Affectionately.
Yes, that's a long aging tag that I've acquired.
You know, sometimes you come here and the weather is just so perfect. I think, well, gee, we couldn't have better weather for having you guys here, because suddenly things have gotten nasty. There, in other parts of the country, we've had early snows.
I have a different attitude. I think every day is a good day. The weather is always good.
But you spend a lot less time climbing around on roofs than I do.
But I used to do it, but I still...
No. Now.
Now? Listen, you know, I'm 76 years old. Come on, I can't climb. But I say, I wake up in the morning, whether it's raining, sun is shining, snowy, whatever it is, my God, I got another day to go.
But you're right. Right now we're talking about heating equipment, and getting that equipment working well. You've already should have had it maintained or adjusted for the new season. But the thing right now is, how can we get those energy bills down? And one of the things would really help is just lowering the thermostat. And lowering the thermostat by going to bed with a little bit more clothes on, or more blankets, or even electric blankets or something like that. Because just to heat a bed is a lot less expensive than heating a whole space.
Yeah, Estelle, we just brought up the heavy blanket now, and we put the light blanket away.
Estelle would be the wife.
Yeah, well, I think the audience got that idea.
I mentioned her name earlier.
Who?
Estelle Ubell.
Yes, Estelle Ubell. It sounds phony, doesn't it? Estelle Ubell. It's too rhythmic. The thing is that for every degree you lower the temperature, you save 2 to 3% of your energy bill. That's phenomenal. I mean, 1 degree and you save it 2, you got 4 degrees, 4%. You keep or down to 6. But that's the whole point. That if you wear pajamas at night and everything else, you could bring that temperature down to about maybe 70 degrees. 60,
that's for people
66.
Who control the temperature. Well,
right
now, a lot of people live in apartments in New York. What am I going to do? Call my landlord and say the place feels nice and toasty. Can you make it a little colder?
Well, in the Big Apple, it's very real. There's no question about it. In the Big Apple, big apartment houses, it's very.
Well, it also depends on who we're talking to. If we're talking to the 1, 2, 3 family homeowners who can control their own heat, yeah, then those people definitely can benefit from this. People who live in multiple dwellings where it's an antiquated system and there's one central thermostat that's not quite adjusted right, or the building's they're just throwing too much heat into the building, those people need to look at it on their own to try to reduce their heat loss, heat waste, and their carbon footprint. And that can be done very easily also. I've said this a few times, but I learned when I went to a convention, one of the heating experts once said, you know what a New York City thermostat is? And I come from New York, I said, what? And he goes, a window.
You reduce the temperature. But the thing is, I'm really confused about what goes on with saving energy, especially for the large buildings. It is not unusual that they can be paying, say, $35,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 a month to heat their buildings, depending upon how big it is. But yet they won't spend $200 or $300 or $400 for an expert to come in and adjust the equipment perfectly. We come into buildings where they have the wrong valves on the radiators, they have the wrong instruments, they don't have the radiators adjusted properly. They have there's so many things that are really decrepit and falling apart, and they don't know that affects the meter, it affects the oil tank, it affects everything down the line.
My guests are Alvin and Lawrence Ubell, the gurus of how to. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692 in just a few moments. Also, you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. I'm afraid to ask you what people who have not taken care of their air conditioners since, because it was so nice until recently, should they be doing something?
Well, first of all, depending upon it, if it's a residential low-rise building, it's really easy, if it's a window unit, is to really maybe wash it out with a hose on the outside, open up the front and the inside, clean that out, even using a little chlorine bleach and wash it and rinse it out, and then cover it over, particularly from the inside, and put some sort of blanketing around it so that none of the heat is lost from the building out through the air conditioning unit.
Can I just shove a plastic bag in there?
Well, a plastic bag, it should be an insulated piece of something. In other words, the plastic bag may be a thermobreak. In other words, it would prevent the air from flowing through, but it will not insulate the heat loss from the room through the air conditioning unit. So it's good to have a blanketed unit on the inside. And those things are sold in most hardware stores and home centers around the country. So it's not a big deal.
But if you have the opportunity to actually remove the window unit, especially if you're paying for your own heat costs, you would want to remove it because when it's in the window and the window is in position, the window still leaks a ton of air.
Now, we have all of our lines are filled, but before we go to the calls, we usually give them the monthly radio word game.
Yeah, we would.
Which one of you is reading it this time?
Well, I could read this. This came up as a result of just my observation on the street, and all of a sudden I said, that's the word. But when I found out what I really call it, it really sort of shook me up a little bit. So this may be a little bit difficult for people to figure out, hopefully, because they've been popping them off, right? Second call, third call, they got it. All right. What is the architectural name given to an arch or vault in a thick, very thick, heavy wall, in turn which supports a heavy load above? And it has at least two different sets of arches within this device, especially it is seen over a window or doorway.
And so we're talking about a series of arches or two arches in conjunction with each other.
Right.
And they don't look the same.
They don't look – usually they're a little bit different than each other, but it is a longstanding architectural element that dates back – couple of thousand years.
Yeah, well, we see it in churches and
yes, you do
other kinds
see it
of buildings, but also in some old buildings and windows.
You see them in they're also in the viaduct in Italy. You see that see remnants of those kinds of arches, but this has got a special arch and it has a special architectural name.
Okay. Now let's take some questions from our audience. Our number here, 212-433-9692. If you have an answer, if you know the answer to this this arch or vault, you can also give us a call at that number. And if people win something,
they'll get a book. They'll get the Save Energy, Save Money that I and my colleague George Merlis, we both edited it and wrote it together.
Mario from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Hello, Mario.
Yeah, hi there. Is the answer to your question an architrave?
No.
Okay, well, my question is this. I had to strip off the sheetrock from a partition because it was harboring mold.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a plumbing problem or a leak. It was just a lot of the constant damp air. And is there a substitute paneling that I can use that's like sheetrock but won't support mold?
with this one, let me ask you a question first, because remember, mold is the symptom,
yeah,
not the problem. If you have mold growth, where is this located? What part of the building?
It's a house in Long Island that is in a very, very damp.
But what I'm
area.
Asking is this: the basement, first floor,
no.
second floor?
Is it exterior wall, interior
no.
wall?
Where? Interior wall on the ground floor, but it's over a very wet crawl space.
Okay. Well, then what?
I'll tell you, it's not there. There is no liquid water involved.
That's okay.
It's just the saturated air.
That's okay. The crawl space is causing the problem. You need to dehumidify, or what I would do is probably the crawl space has probably vents in it.
Yeah.
Okay. These days, you should look up what they're saying about closed crawl space technology,
right,
which is now we're closing it up, we're conditioning the air in there, sealing the floors so the moisture can't get up, and even throwing a dehumidifier in there. Yeah. I would try that. You can always use Wonderboard. You can always use the bathroom-designed drywall. There are new applications, but your problem...
What about fiberglass-faced...
But that's
sheetrock.
You could use that, but that's not your problem.
No.
Your problem is getting the humidity level down in that crawl space, and then the rest of the building would start performing much better. If you can keep that humidity level in that crawl space around 60%, right now I'm probably guessing it's about 80, 90% in there, and you probably have mold growth inside the crawl space, which is not healthy. So that's what I would do. Once you get that problem solved, then you won't. You could use regular sheetrock.
Yeah, and also, no matter what material you're going to use, if you don't correct the ventilation problem or the moisture problem that is going up that cavity, anything you put there is going to cause mold.
Yeah. Now, along these lines, Rochelle mm-hmm. on the Jersey Shore left a comment on our show page. She mm-hmm. said black gunk, she assumes is it's mold, mm-hmm. is on the aerator screen of both her kitchen, including that spray thing, and bathroom sinks. She cleans it off almost weekly, but it keeps coming back. Have you heard of mold in a supply line like that? There is no leak or drip that I can detect. How can I stop
it? Well, it could be the relative humidity.
No, I think that's not what it is. What's happening is there is probably inside some of the piping somewhere in the system. It may not necessarily be in her building, but it's lined with there's mold in the supply line system, and it's coming off. It could also have been
condensation. Or
it also could have been because they did work on the line in the municipality there. That black gunk does form from time to time, but it needs to be cleaned out. If it keeps going, I would actually contact the local municipality and find out what's going on with the water supply system. Okay, because I don't think this is a, because most pipes are copper pipes, so light can't get in there to help the mold growth or to cause that kind of problem. I think it might be something either in her, it could also be in a water heater, it could also be in her, maybe she has a filter or a water softening system for her building. She needs to look at all these things first.
We have a call from Jim from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Jim.
How you doing?
Good. What's going on?
Well, I have an upstairs apartment that's always had space heaters to heat the system.
Mm-hmm.
And our problem is that even though we have a new heater, we keep burning out the thermocouplers that hold the gas valve open.
You're burning out the thermocoupling?
Now, these are gas space heaters, you said?
Right.
And the thermocoupling keeps going out? The thermocoupling...
Yeah, maybe like four or five times in the wintertime we have to replace it. It's that like that tubular type, but... thermocouple?
You know, right. But the thermocoupling, this is a pilot light on that thermocoupling, right? And the pilot light is lit all the time.
No, right.
The pilot light is lit all the time, and that heats up the thermocoupling, which produces the electricity, which makes the thing operate.
Right, exactly, and we've had to replace that over
pilot
the last
light, day. That pilot light may be too big. It might be burning out the element.
Or the bulb of the thermocoupling is too far into the flame. It doesn't have to be right in the flame. It could be adjacent to
just the tip of it has to be
adjacent
the tip
to
of it. Because you have to understand how that works. That has a bimetal
Is this one he's talking about a power pile or is it a thermocoupling? Because thermocoupling works on an expansion of a refrigerant.
That's true too, but they have the power pile is what they mostly work from, where that little power pile produces electricity through two dissimilar metals twisted together.
So I would try adjusting the pilot light and the contact point of the thermocoupling. Okay.
We thank you for your call. A listener, Max, left a question that seems to me to be connected in some ways. He says, I'm moving to a new apartment with a wall AC heating unit. Is there a rule of thumb on how I should place furniture such as a couch from the unit? Basically, is blocking the unit detrimental to efficiency?
Absolutely. Any kind of unit that is in front of any kind of heating or air conditioning unit is going to stifle its efficiency. If you put a couch in front of a radiator, the radiator is not going to produce heat because a radiator has to do two things. It has to convect the air through the room, and it also has to radiate the heat from the unit outward in a straight line. Air conditioning is a little bit
different. So all your heating is the back of the sofa.
That's exactly what's
happening. Or air conditioning it. The other thing I was going to say about that is that you have to we make compromises when we make designs, because you have to either decide how you're going to heat or how you're going to decorate or whatever. What we've decided is that I personally rather have my heat in one space and say that's the one space I cannot put anything in front of, as opposed to where they do baseboard radiators around the whole room, and in the whole room you actually have to keep the equipment away from that convector radiator, that baseboard. So in this case, he has to really decide that this is basically a no furniture zone, or at least give it at least a foot or so, 8 inches to a foot in front of it, so the thing can breathe.
But if it's a radiator that with a couch or something like that, or a piece of furniture, it's good to take a piece of aluminum foil and put it right on the furniture itself, which is going to face the radiator, whichever they have there, and this will make the air flow upward between the space, and the space should be at least 6 to 8 inches away from the radiator.
But this piece of equipment sounds like it's a PTAC unit. In other words, a packaged terminal air conditioning system, so it produces both heat
like
pump
an,
and air.
Like, yeah. Like an incremental
yeah.
unit.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, I know what it is.
Yeah.
I hope the audience does.
We have to go to a break. Should I check out whether anybody got an answer to the quiz?
Absolutely.
Sure. Okay, we'll do that quickly, and then we'll go to a break. Mary Lynn from Manhattan, what do you think it is?
Is it my favorite thing from art history of a buttress or a flying buttress?
No.
Oh.
But those are nice, too.
We're talking about this is a combination of multiple arches within an entranceway to a window or a door.
And a flying buttress is what is holding up the wall of a very heavy.
It's taking the strain of a long joist or diagonal, or sometimes it's just straight up and down. It's a buildup of mass in order to support something else.
Avi from the East Village, what do you think it is?
I think I was actually going to say the same thing, but. Is it a keystone, maybe? I don't know.
No.
The keystone is the thing that holds the arch together at the summit of the arch.
And the keystone would be there.
Yeah, the keystone was there.
But
not all arches have keystones, but that's where the keystone is.
And we'll keep the keystone cops out of this whole thing, right?
Right.
Alvin and Lawrence Ubell are my guests. Al and Larry Ubell, the gurus of how to, also known as Accurate.
Accurate building inspectors.
How accurate are you? Well, we'll get into that some other time. Accurate building
inspectors. Actually, there's something about that, but we'll get back to it afterwards.
We have to take a little break. Have you agreed to host a holiday meal only to have disaster strike in the kitchen? Did the stuffing come out dry or too mushy? Did you burn the turkey? Well, we want to hear your cooking horror stories. Just go to our show page and share your experience. And then on December 14th, we'll talk with Chris Kimball from America's Test Kitchens about tips to avoid repeating your culinary disasters. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with the gurus of how to, Al and Larry Ubell, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692 or your comments at WNYC.org. Frankie from Maplewood wrote, I recently converted from oil to gas heat. I have an oil burner and a converted gas burner. The gas line, which is the original one, comes from the meter to the water heater and is a half-inch pipe. The gas line runs from there to the converter, also a half-inch pipe. Is it necessary to replace the pipe with 1 inch? Is it necessary to go to the converter independently or first? I've been getting conflicting advice.
Well, that what it has to be doing, you've got to call the utility company on that, because they have devices that can tell you whether you have the right pressure and the right mixture of air or oxygen and the combustible gas. And if they read that the effluent that comes off of that flame doesn't have enough carbon dioxide in it. That means you're not burning all of the gas because of the low pressure. Or sometimes that happens with high pressure. In other words, something is going wrong, and the actual output of that flame has to be tested with a special instrument.
But there's also the other thing is, what is A, the equipment require? Is it a half-inch tap-out for the new burner? And is there a half-inch tap-out for the water heater? And are both of those match? And also, they have to test the pressure at both fixtures, and there are special tap-offs on the gas valves for that, to test what the pressure is at both units when they're both operating.
Yes, when they're simultaneously operating.
But really, a licensed plumber should be able to advise you on that. I would, now, just rule of thumb, I would imagine that if you're going to have two half-inch devices, chances are you probably need a three-quarter-inch pipe feeding both of those to get the kind of volume that you need when they're both operational.
But it also has to do with the BTU absorption of that system.
That's
correct. And how much flame or how much heat that unit really requires.
So I'm glad you understood that question.
So without access to the specifications of the equipment and also what the pressure is coming off the meter, it's hard to answer that question.
Okay.
So that was a long-winded question to not answer it.
Janine from the Bronx, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Janine.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good, what's up?
Good. I live in a three-story house, and we have baseboard heating. Mm-hmm. And last winter when it was really cold, I live up north, it was below freezing for many days. We lost heat on our main level.
Mm-hmm.
And our fuel guys said we are turning the heat, we have a thermostat, we are letting it go too far down at night. It was going down to 62.
That's too cold.
That's too cold.
Actually, I'd like to let her finish what she was going to say.
Our bedrooms are upstairs. So our bedrooms, we go down to 67 at night, but we're a kitchen and living room, et cetera. We just bring it down to 62, and it did freeze. So this year he said, don't do any temperature fluctuations, or if you do, just do 2 or 3 degrees, you know, going down from like 68 to 66.
Yeah, okay.
Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, is that reasonable? I would like to get it down lower to save more money, but obviously I don't want the pipes freezing again, and I wasn't sure if he was just trying to buying fuel.
For livability, depending upon how many sweaters you wear how much energy your own body takes out and what's going on in the building, you should never bring it down below 65. 65 in cold weather is really very cold in the house.
Yeah, no, I know.
But you know what? I got to tell you. I need to interrupt. The problem is that the pipes are freezing.
Yes.
And if the pipes are freezing, then there's a bad installation with the pipes.
There's no question about that.
And that's really what we have to tackle. Because to tell you the truth, you should be able to leave a building at 55 degrees and nothing happen. Mm-hmm. You should be able to. I mean, because I lower my heat to 55 degrees all the time. And it gets to 55, and it'll be the middle of the winter, and it's 20 degrees outside, and it's 55 degrees inside. I don't have a frozen pipe. I don't have anything cracking. And when I heat my building up, it takes about 2 hours for it to get up to temperature.
Well, the question is, where are these pipes? Are the pipes on the exterior walls or are they interior walls?
If they're on the exterior, on the exterior walls.
If they're on exterior walls, the plumber put them in the wrong place.
That's what the point I was getting to, is that there was definitely a problem of the way they install. Like, for instance, in my heating system, and I'm using, which is a hot water system, my main riser goes up the middle of the building and then separates toward the outside. And so all my heating pipes are toward the center, but my radiators are on the exterior. With a baseboard system, a lot of times they'll just be very cheap and just run them around the exterior and then run them down the box beam on the outside of the building, and that exposes it to too much cold. So what you really need to look at is where is these areas where the pipe is exposed and vulnerable, and maybe either insulate them better there, relocate them, replumb them, or something to that effect to get that problem resolved, because you should be able to save as much energy as you want. Obviously, you don't want to get the building down below 55. That's dangerous. But 55, you shouldn't really have a problem. Alvin?
All right, but you should never, if you're going to insulate the pipes that are on the outside wall, the insulation should be only put between the pipe and the outside wall. You should leave the pipe exposed on the toward the inside of the building so as to permit the heat to get to it. Also, if that is if the sheetrock or the plaster board is put over those areas where the pipe is freezing, by right you should have ventilators in those holes next to the pipe so that the heat can go migrate to those pipes to prevent it from freezing.
Here's another pipe freezing question. Barry from Passaic, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. It's a similar question. If the heat goes quite low, the pipes apparently can freeze. What exactly does that mean?
It means that actually it's in the outer envelope of the building, which is where the major heat loss is. But one thing I want
to... If you run hot water through them, or you run your water through them on a regular be preventing that?
No. Well, what kind of pipes are we talking about? Are we talking about the heating pipes, or are we talking about the supply water, hot and cold?
Well, both, really.
Okay.
The radiators, I guess.
But one thing I wanted to say, get back to the baseboards, is that people also have to realize that the fins and the vents on the tops of the baseboard radiators have to be open. A lot of times I will do an inspection, and the people say it's always cold in here because those louvers are adjustments to adjust the room. And a lot of times they're always closed, and people wonder why they're not getting heat into the room.
And they have to open them up. But as far as the pipes are freezing, whether it's hot or cold water, eventually the heat loss from the hot water pipe will be gone if you turn down the heat in the building, and then all of a sudden the water goes down below 32 degrees and it starts freezing, and that ice starts to expand, and that's what bursts the pipes in the walls.
I have to say that it occurs to me that what they've done is some of the plumbers, when they run these either heating pipes or hot and cold supply water pipes up the exterior of the building, they've actually made a decision for the homeowner that you cannot lower the heat because we've done a less expensive way of putting the pipes in. So you either pay for it in the front, or now you're paying it long term in higher heating costs when you actually want to try to save money.
We go now to Opal from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Opal.
I've been having a problem with backup from my next-door neighbor from the bathtub. He's a dancer, and he's always taking baths. And they have come to fix it over the years. And they put a snake down, and they changed some of the pipes in my bath.
Let me jump in here a second. Let me jump in. In other words, he takes a bath, he lets his water out, and the water from his bathtub comes up in your bathtub.
You got it.
Okay, fine. And also, his apartment is like a mirror image of yours.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. I got the whole visual. What's happening is there's a blockage,
right,
and they actually need to open up the ceiling of the apartment below the two of yous, that's great English. The two of your apartments.
Y'all's
apartment. You have to open that up.
I understand what you're saying.
Or open up from one of your two apartments to clear. This is an old building, rent control building?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, got it. The cast iron waistlines there are so covered with stuff that probably the orifice now is probably a half an inch to an inch wide, where it probably used to be 2 to 3 inches wide.
They have to take a cleaning snake to really clean it out.
I think at this point there's no way, because all the snake is going to do is pop through, and it's not going to get all the crud that's lining the pipes now.
You're saying new pipe?
New pipe at that area. That's what's going on.
Well, they have to find out where.
But what you have to do is, let me finish my thought. What you have to do is call HPD and tell them you have an unsanitary condition.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Because that is an unsanitary.
It is. It's disgusting.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay? You don't need his water up in your tub.
Good luck, Opal.
Good luck with that.
Michael from Rockaway. Hi.
Good afternoon, you guys.
Yes, thank you.
Could you explain?
I'm not going to live that one down, am I?
it's like I'm going to blow those Mises to pieces. You know?
I like that one better, but
right.
Go on.
Well, the mouse problem we got rid of by putting, maybe you could tell me if this is the right thing I did, putting steel wool around the spaces where the baseboard pipe comes through, the oven pipe, wherever there's like a little space around that hole in the wall where the pipe comes through. I was told that the mice don't eat through steel wool.
Yeah, well, that's really good. But what I would do even better than that, if you buy some with the steel wool, and you also buy some spackling compound, and you actually mix the steel wool with the spackling compound, and then stuff it in there, the spackling compound will solidify and hold the whole thing in place forever.
But
after a while, if you just put...
It just becomes wall, in fact.
It becomes... Right. Mm. And if you just put the steel wool there, eventually they'll pick at it and pick at it and pick at it until that comes out and they get their access. They are very persistent. They send one family after another family until it gets done.
But there's also my alternative, which is the expanding foam. That's boning foam insulation. You spray that around it and fill up the gap with that, they'll never eat through it because that stuff must taste awful. Because I had a major squirrel problem in my attic, and I filled up the gaps with that, and I haven't had a problem since. So that works really, really well.
It's also probably very poisonous.
I want to tell you that nobody's gotten the answer to your quiz.
Great.
A number of people have called in. You're going to have to do this again next
Excellent.
Month. But I do want to get to one more.
We were having bets on that we could.
This is a toughie.
Yeah.
David, you'll be back on the 13th. Just very quickly, David left a comment on our show page. Last time you identified how I was causing mold to form on my living room blower unit. I have a raised floor and it wasn't getting proper circulation. I'm trying to take care of that. But now I realize that I have a serious problem, which is causing me respiratory problems. I think that I have mold mildew throughout the blower, not just on the surface. Mm-hmm. I know how to clean the surface, but how do I clean inside the blower unit, the fan, the filter, et cetera?
You have to really dismantle it, take the covers off. One of the things I'd recommend is that I would find the name of the manufacturer and get the manuals and take it apart and clean out every part of it, and that would work.
Another question in just the brief time we have left. Ed in Larchmont asked, what should the pressure be on a home furnace? We're on the second floor and the radiators aren't going on enough. We think it's the pressure.
If this is a steam system in
No. I think it's a hot water system.
A hot water system? We don't know
two
how many
floors.
Stories.
He did. Two floors.
That should be about... That should not be greater than about maybe 12 pounds.
But if you set it about 20 pounds, you're safe. You're not going to overload the system, and you should get the heat up. But you maybe don't have air bleeder valves, and you need to bleed the system. And you may need to put a bleeder valve on the system.
Right now, we have pretty much run out of time. But my great thanks to the gurus of how-to, Al and Larry Ubell. I'm sorry that none of you got the answer, but next month you'll be back, and
we will show all
what will happen.
We
when
will
you come
show
back?
all of America how to go forth and fix, save energy, money, and
do it safely.
And I've forgotten the day that you're coming back. Do you remember?
13th.
The 13th is it? January.
That's January 13th.
It's not a Friday.
We'll see all of you guys next year.
On tomorrow's show, Peter Brown's proposal for a new economic model, which he calls a whole earth economy. Then Jim Norton and Kate Baldwin on starring in the first Broadway revival of Finian's Rainbow in nearly 50 years. Plus, Steve Terrell discusses his transition from a Grammy-winning producer to a successful singer, and our latest underreported segments. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Fran Jacobs, Colin Adams-Toomey, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Fanta was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.